From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Well, I'm gone away to live. Won't be back no more. Going back down south, child, don't you want to go. Well, when I'm trouble, I be all good night. Well, babe, I just can't be satisfied, and I just can't keep on.
Rolling Stone guitarist Keith Richards once said, when you listen to Muddy Waters, you can hear all the angst and all of the power and all of the hardship that made the man. Hardship has always gone hand in hand with blues music, and the Mississippi Delta plantations that Muddy Waters grew up on were as fertile for hardship as they were for endless crops of cotton. As Southern blacks migrated north to escape plantation life, they brought the blues with them. At each stop, Memphis, Kansas City, St. Louis, the blues changed. It became quicker, louder, and more raw. In mighty Chicago, the great black destination, it became a global force. And no one was more influential in shaping the Chicago blues than Muddy Waters. Muddy Waters was the link between the dark and brooding Mississippi bottleneck blues and the hard-edged, urban, and electrified Chicago blues. He developed a sound and style that would shape all popular music from the 40s on and guide a generation of musicians from the Rolling Stones to Bob Dylan to Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton. To remember his life and music, tonight, the music of Muddy Waters, we're joined by Robert Gordon, author of Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. Good evening and welcome, Robert Gordon.
Thanks for having me here, Tom.
It's great to have you and great to have Muddy Waters here with us as well. It is an incredible story that you share in your new book, Can't Be Satisfied, a story about a musician and really, in a fundamental way, a story about America and American culture. Give us, before we dive into the personal story of this man, and it's an incredible one, what's the musical significance of Muddy Waters?
Well, people like to say that he invented the electric blues. I mean, he definitely developed it, you know. Mm-hmm. He took the sound that was played by a lone guitarist in the Mississippi Delta with all that feeling and all that power, and he transformed it to a band and conveyed it with feeling and emotion.
Feeling and emotion.
And he juiced it.
And juiced it.
He juiced it.
And
plugged it in.
And that juice was heard around the world. We quoted Keith Richards earlier, but the Rolling Stones took their name from a Muddy Waters song. Bands all over the world were inspired by this blues in the 50s and into the 60s. But Muddy Waters, unlike the rock and roll generation that came after him, was no child when he first came into recording. He had a long history, youth in the Mississippi Delta. Tell us about the origins of Muddy Waters.
He's born in the Mississippi Delta, which is a very rural land even today. He's born in 1913 and will live basically, you know, over the whole century. So his story is a great 20th century story as he eventually works his way from the south to the north, from the rural to the urban. In the Delta, he was from a farming community, sharecroppers.
And really, as you describe it, a community that still had the structure of the antebellum plantation world in many respects.
Well, sharecropping was supposed to be the alternative, the improvement over slavery, but it actually was not. It was a way to keep the farm labor indentured. The sharecropper was supplied by the plantation with a furnish. The furnish was their home. Plantation furnished a home. Mm-hmm. They furnished some land. They furnished a mule, seeds. And then croppers had the responsibility to raise their cotton. And at the end, at the harvest, they would take it in. And then at the plantation store, everything happens, you know, on the same place on the plantation. Half of it was taken off the top. And then from the half that was left, the plantation owners deducted expenses, the furnish. The furnish was deducted. Well, you know, we got to take out a bale here for your house and a bale here for your shirt. Hey, that's an expensive shirt. You know, but these guys couldn't read, so.
And it essentially kept these sharecroppers deep, deep in poverty.
Absolutely.
And Muddy Waters knew that well. He was not a marginal observer of this life. He worked those fields.
Right. From, you know, childhood on, he began as a water boy the youngest was always kept with a pail and a ladle, and someone from the field would holler, "Water!" And it would be his job to go bring them a ladle and cool them off. So from that time on, he worked in the fields, and that's where, and people used to communicate through song in the field, you know. Mm-hmm. "You're so far off, let me holler this to you." And a lot of the hollers became standardized, too.
Call and response right across the cotton. He was born McKinley Morganfield. What a name. He became known as Muddy Waters. Where did he get that name?
It's an indication of the land, you know, the marsh. That he played outside of his grandmother's cabin, and it was right at the foot of the levee of the Mississippi River, and it was wet. So, you know, he got covered
there
in mud.
There was Muddy Waters. In 1941, he was no child anymore, and out of the blue comes Alan Lomax with recording equipment in his old car, making recordings for the Library of Congress. Describe that meeting. It's an incredible meeting that you open your book with, Robert Gordon.
You got this farm guy who gets word that a white man's looking for him. That's the word he gets. Mm-hmm. And so he thinks it's the revenue agent out to bust him for his moonshine. And so he leaves his house as fast as he can so that the agent won't find him there. And they meet up at the store. And Lomax, who's there with another guy named John Work, a black musicologist, Lomax has to convince Muddy that he's there to record him. "Hey, I'm here to fulfill your dream."
Not
and
to
Muddy
bust
keeps
you.
Thinking, yeah, and Muddy keeps thinking, man, he's a tricky cop who's trying to tell me he's going to fulfill my dream, you know, just so he can bust me. And in the end, what convinces him is that Lomax asks for a drink of water, and Muddy has only one cup, and he's already drank out of it. And when Mud sees Lomax drink out of the same cup as him, he says, "Man, no tricky cop would do that. This guy's for real.
This is no Southern cop." It's a very touching moment you describe when Muddy Waters, the black man raised in sharecropping Mississippi, sees Alan Lomax drink out of the same cup and says, "This is something new." What was Alan Lomax doing in the South collecting these recordings?
This guy, this black musicologist from Fisk in Nashville, a black college, had...
This is John Work.
John Work, right. John Work instigated this trip, and they, because he wanted to collect songs in the what they then called the Negro vernacular, you know, the daily songs, because at Fisk they were learning, you know, chorale and Eurocentric things, and John Work realized, no, that the music of our own culture is so great, let's collect that. And by appealing to the Library of Congress, Lomax joined in, and they went down there to study the sound of the black vernacular in the daily culture.
You hear, coming up behind us, what I believe, Robert Gordon, correct me if I'm wrong, is one of those recordings, I Be Troubled.
Absolutely.
Now, this was made, if I understand it, on recording equipment that Alan Lomax was driving around in the back of his car in Mississippi.
That's right. And they unpack it and set it up on... Muddy's front porch, and he records these field recordings. Can't Be Satisfied is the one we're hearing.
Let's listen for a moment to the earliest recordings of Muddy Waters.
"Yeah, I know my little old bae, she gonna jump and shout. That old train be late, girl, and I come walking. But I'm troubled, I'm out. And I never be satisfied, and I just can't keep up. Yeah, I know somebody sure been talking to you. I don't need no telling, girl, I can watch the way. But I'm troubled, I'll be all right. Yeah, I never be satisfied, and I just can't keep up."
Muddy Waters is recorded by Alan Lomax with John Work along in 1941, I believe, in the back of Alan Lomax's car. Here's the bottleneck Mississippi Delta sound. What is the bottleneck sound? What makes that, Robert Gordon?
Back in the day, it was actually a neck of a bottle that they would put over their pinky finger and slide it on the strings.
To give it that slide, kind of twang slide sound.
Yeah, that keening, you know, mm-hmm. that is, you heard it particularly strong in the beginning there.
Almost mimicking the human voice.
Very much so.
John Work was a university professor, black, but from high black culture. What was the attitude of high black culture toward Mississippi Delta blues in the 40s?
They didn't give it too much respect. The dirt farmers, the sharecroppers, were the, you know, they were not recorded. You know, their culture was not recorded by the whites, and the blacks looked at them sort of with disdain. So they were this isolated, you know, lower rung.
We have a little clip of an interview that John Work, traveling with Alan Lomax, did with Muddy Waters. Let's listen to just a minute of that from I guess, that first meeting in the 1940s.
How did you come to develop that? Where did you first hear it?
I made that up my own, sir. That's the song I made it.
How did you come to make it up?
Well, the reason I come to make that record up once, I was just walking along the road and I heard a church song, kind of minor that. I just deal off a little song from there. And I started to think.
Well, do you make up verses and things often like that, just sitting around?
Yes, I make up verses.
The idea comes to you and you build it up?
I build them up.
And then how do you get the music? You get your tunes to it after you get the
After
verses.
I get my verses laid up, then I come get my guitar and try two or three different tunes, see which one takes the best one. It'll be the better to play it in. Then I start.
Are there many these country blues around in this neighborhood?
Yeah, there ain't so many around in here, but good little deal too.
Do the people around here like them?
Yeah, they're crazy about it.
There's Muddy Waters talking in 1941 with black academic John Work, who was traveling with Alan Lomax, collecting recordings of Mississippi Delta blues for the Library of Congress. He says he asked Muddy Waters, "Where did you come up with this song?" And if I heard it right, Muddy Waters says, "I made it up my own self."
That's great. Yeah, he says it put him in mind of a church song, and he dealed off a few verses.
That's great.
I love it.
You describe how Muddy Waters, who by this point was no amateur musician, he'd been playing a lot. He was nearly 30 and had been playing a lot for the folks in his own community. But when he heard himself on the recording, heard his own voice and his own music playing back, it kind of struck him like a thunderbolt.
Yes, man, I can sing, he said. It's the validation, essentially. You know, his friends have been going up to Chicago and making, you know, saying, "Hey, Mud, come on, we're going to Chicago." He goes, "Man, you know, that just seems so far away to him. He couldn't do it." And these guys came back with recordings. He heard about them on the jukebox. You know, "Hey, here's this guy on the jukebox."
Chicago was the great destination of those days, and Muddy Waters was soon on his way. We're talking tonight with biographer Robert Gordon about Muddy Waters and Robert Gordon's new book, Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. We'll come back and talk about Muddy Waters' migration along with much of the Black South to Chicago after a break. We're going out listening to You're Going to Miss Me When I'm Gone. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
When I'm dead and gone, well, you know you're gonna miss me, baby, now. When I'm dead and gone, yeah, man, you know she's gonna miss you. Whiskey boy than I was a diving duck. I would dive to the bottom, baby, never. I come up, but hey, she would miss me. Boy, I'd be dead and gone. She would have to miss me, man, rolling in a hole.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the great blues man Muddy Waters with biographer Robert Gordon, author of Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. Here's the Muddy Waters song, I Feel Like Going Home.
Well, now getting late over in the evening, I feel like blowing my horn. When I woke up this morning, all I have was gone again. Late over in the evening, man, now I feel like blowing my horn. Well, I woke up this morning, all I have was gone.
Robert Gordon, there's Muddy Waters, having made his way to Chicago, jumped in to recording, though not immediately. He came north in 1943, I think. Tell us about that journey and the migration it was part of.
Well, that was the great migration from the south to the north had been going on since the 20s, and he rides like the big wave in the middle. And I think in this recording, which is from 1948, he's picked up the electric guitar. You're still hearing the delta. You know, it's still very strongly a delta recording, but there's a little bit of that Chicago electricity, sort of new sound beginning to creep in. Life is different in Chicago, and it's being expressed in the art.
Chicago was all about electrification, amplification. How did that new technology, I guess, change the blues?
Well, it allowed the band to form. You know, when everybody could get amplified, suddenly a harmonica and an electric guitar could share the stage. And drums, you know, big drums. It was great. The first years in Chicago, they didn't have a drummer because in the Delta, people weren't trained to be drummers. The guitarist just beat his foot on the floor of the shack, and that was the percussion.
Wow. Describe the scene for us there that Muddy Waters moved into. He didn't get recorded right away. He was in Chicago for almost 5 years before that happened. What was the culture, the environment, and what was he doing for those years getting established as a musician in Chicago?
He was committed to becoming a musician. He got a job immediately in a factory, and over the 5 years, he just assumed different factory jobs. He said, all I wanted was those cheap jobs because he was bringing home $40 a week, which was as much as he'd made in a year in the South sometimes. And that gave him the freedom to do the clubs at night, do the house parties at night, and begin to work his way up to when he makes that recording we just heard, he becomes a star. That's sort of like his presence is announced in Chicago, and the record is bought up over the first weekend it's out.
The path to that recording is kind of an incredible one. It came out on Chess Records, produced by the Chess Brothers. Who were they, and how did Muddy Waters meet them?
While he's beginning to work his way up, he takes a job in a club, and the Chesses ran a club. So they're on the same circuit.
Mm-hmm.
And the Chesses were seeing that people were coming into their club to record the band, to talk to the band about recording, and that when the band would make a record, the bar patrons who were buying drinks were also buying records. And they said, hey, let's get a piece of that. You know, it was a keen commerce eye.
So the Chess Brothers were not already recording chieftains, but they got into it because they could double up the bar revenue.
Essentially, yeah, they saw there was a bigger buck. And they probably thought there was going to be fewer fights, though I'm not sure if they were right or wrong.
Who were the Chess Brothers, and what was their relationship with Muddy Waters like?
They were Polish Jews who came over as children, worked their way up in the liquor business, developed this record label called Chess that would later include, in addition to Muddy Waters, would include Howlin' Wolf, Little Walter, Chuck Berry, just a whole range of people.
Were they music aficionados?
Not at all. They were dollar aficionados, you know, but they got a real hang of it. Leonard, in the studio, coaxed great performances. He was very antagonistic in a friendly way. And, you know, you can hear them in session tapes sort of bullying each other in a way, doing the dozens almost in a way. And I think that Leonard realized by riling up his artists, he could get them to make great recordings. And, you know, that's a great insight. It worked brilliantly.
Let's keep the sound in our ears. Here's Still a Fool from Muddy Waters.
Well, now it's two. That's two trains running. Well, ain't now one hole going my way. Well, now one run at midnight, the other one running just for day. They're running just for day. It's running just for day.
Muddy Waters. In Chicago in the 1940s with Still a Fool, produced by the Chess Brothers, what was the relationship, Robert Gordon, between this son of the Mississippi Delta and the Polish bar owners who became his record producers?
Well, I think in large part, Muddy made it similar to what he'd known on the plantation. That was a way he knew how to work. So he sort of put Leonard as the boss man and kind of assumed, over the years, assumed the furnish from the Chess label. You know, when times were bad, they took care of him. When times were good, it was good for them both. And the sound of this song, that's the, that there we are at the bedrock of rock and roll, the bedrock of the urban blues. That guitar is not something they knew in the Delta.
The amplifier is turned right up there, and you can hear that deep rocking beat.
I talked to Muddy's brother, who stayed in Rolling Fork in the Delta, and he said that when Muddy came back to visit after he'd already begun to record, that was the first time he saw an electric guitar. So, you know, think about hearing that sound. He's up north making that sound, and when he carries it down south, you know, it really just shocks them.
Yeah.
And up north, you know, there's this whole group of Southerners who've moved up north who are just have, you know, followed that sound exactly. He's playing their life. And that's why he becomes so popular.
And there's a legendary group of musicians in and around Muddy Waters, in and around Chicago. Talk to us about the bluesmen who were part of that world.
Well, he was a great band leader in that he encouraged his side players to step to the fore. And so there's essentially, you know, his school of blues, like there's an Ellingtonian school of jazz. Blues stars as early as Jimmy Rogers and Little Walter, on through to James Cotton, Paul Asher, Bob Margolin. A lot of people learned to be band leaders in his band.
How did the Muddy Waters blues sound hit the American mainstream? Was it a big success right away? Who picked it up? Who ran with it? Was it getting airtime on the radio waves? Was it condemned as the devil's music? What was the reception?
There's a lot of people who would say, as yet now, it hasn't been received. A lot of blues players out there would probably say that. Though, in effect, it had to be translated to be received. The British invasion sounds of the 1960s were built on the sounds that Muddy and other bluesmen were making on the south side of Chicago. And so that's how the American mainstream accepted blues. You know, through rock and roll, they said, oh, you know, it came from there, and they began to look in their own backyard.
And those sounds were built very explicitly on the Muddy Waters sound. Keith Richards writes in the foreword to
yes.
the book about meeting up with Mick Jagger in 1961. Jagger had a Chuck Berry record and a copy of the best of Muddy Waters. They sat around listening to it. Keith Richards writes that it was the most powerful music he'd ever heard, the most expressive, and they named the band
right at the outset.
They needed a name, and they pulled it right out of a Muddy Waters song. Let's listen to another as he moved into greater commercial success. Here's Hoochie Coochie Man. Tell us about the origin of this song.
Well, this is a song really written for Muddy by Willie Dixon. It's just based on his persona.
Hoochie Coochie Man, Muddy Waters.
Everybody knows him. I got a black cat bone. I got a mojo too. I got a John the Conqueror. I got to mess with you. I'm gonna make you good. Leave me by my hand. Then the world will know I'm a hoochie coochie man. But you know I'm here.
And here's something else that the blues helped to bring in to American mainstream music, a kind of overt sexuality that's there in the tempo, that's there in the language of these songs, Robert Gordon.
Yes. I, you know, knew going into this that blues guys sort of made the rock and roll sound. You know, that's where it came from. But it hadn't occurred to me until I began to really get into Muddy's life that he also was responsible for the persona, you know, sex and booze and blues. You know, it was, he was a wild man.
Tell us about that lifestyle that emerged as Muddy Waters met with commercial success and was no longer working in a factory or driving a truck.
He was a very charismatic singer, and many people described to me sitting in clubs and watching him stir up the ladies, you know, swinging their purses, throwing things at them. He would, you know, during a song called I'm a Man, he would shake a Coke bottle and, you know, it would fizz. I mean, it was very... The sexuality was very open and very explicit.
When he sang about the motion, we all knew what motion that was.
Yes, indeed.
Was he a ladies' man? Did he travel the country and beyond? Did this music take?
He traveled with a different road wife almost every trip, you know. He would just go out. Yeah, but so he goes to England in 1958, and they're expecting this country, rural thing, and he goes over there with his electric guitar and amp. The famous critic in the audience writes that every time that Muddy touched the knob on his guitar, he had to scoop back a few more rows until he was out of the auditorium. And that became the line in the sand. You know, those who didn't like the electric sound became old school, and those who did, the young kids, all bought guitars, so an amplifier. So on subsequent visits, you know, the electric sound got pushed into them, and they formed their bands and shipped it back to us as the British explosion.
Hoochie Coochie Man was his last big commercial success, but he continued to be very influential. Rolling Stone came along at a time when the blues was beginning, I guess, to run into rock and roll. It's heir apparent.
the Stones picked up the sound, like when they heard the song we're hearing in the background.
Rolling Stone.
Yes. They said, you know, this is a band. This is a lifestyle. Keith told me that, you know, they wanted to be a code book that would take people to this.
I went to my baby's house, and I sat down on her step. She said, come on in now, buddy, you know my husband just now left. Showing up and just not little. Showing up and just not little. Oh, Lord. Oh, well. Oh, well. Well, my mother.
Of course, as much as the Rolling Stones might have seen themselves as doing the bluesmen a favor, this was also a code book for their own success. There were many rock and roll groups who leaned very explicitly and heavily on the legacy of Muddy Waters and the blues of his time.
And in a way, you know, it took a decade or so, but he did get the payback. You know, he got the thank you. His blues suffered from the latter 50s. It had periodic high moments, but, you know, he didn't really get his due until the 70s in a very strong comeback.
And what would you call his due? How did that finally come to him, and what form?
He left the Chess label, got a deal with CBS Records, who could really put him out there. He got to make a new recording under new circumstances. Johnny Winter, a rock guitarist, that sort of restored the old integrity. And as a result, Muddy got to travel, open shows for Eric Clapton, travel in arenas. He could fly when he, you know, anytime he wanted. He got financial reward.
We're talking this hour about Muddy Waters with biographer Robert Gordon, about the blues man from the Delta who brought it north to Chicago and made it real for millions of Americans and ultimately seeded blues into the heart of rock and roll. Did he have the feeling that he'd been done right by Robert Gordon?
Did he have the feeling he'd been done right? I think the good thing was that when the Stones would have press conferences, or the Beatles, or, you know, those early British invasion bands. There's a great story. The Americans say, you know, tell us what you want to see while you're here. And they say, Bo Diddley and Muddy Waters. And the reporter says, where's that? You know, he didn't know it was a person. And so because these British people kept pointing it out to the American public, that made him feel good, you know. And, of course, when they covered songs he wrote and he got paychecks, that made him feel good. Hmm. So, you know, it just – and then ultimately he got the respect and attention from his home country that, you know, he felt – I think in the end he felt like he'd gotten the proper respect. A long time coming, though.
A long time coming. Let's go into the break listening to I Just Want to Make Love to You. Covered later by the Rolling Stones, Foghat, Jimi Hendrix, everybody, but here by the original, Muddy Waters. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I don't want you to wash my clothes. I don't want you to keep a hold. I don't want your money too. I just want to make shame. I don't want you to cook my bread. I don't want you to make my bed. I don't want you because I'm sad and blue. I just want to make
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the music of Muddy Waters with biographer Robert Gordon, author of Can't Be Satisfied. Here from 1962, Muddy Waters with You Need Love.
You got yarning and I got bunny. Baby, you look so sweet and cunning. Baby, way down inside, woman, you need love. Woman, you need love. You got to have some love. I'm gonna give you some love. I know you need love. You just got to have love. You got to have some love. You make me feel so good. You make me feel all right. You make me feel so good. Oh, you make me feel all right.
Robert Gordon, Led Zeppelin was listening, weren't they?
Yes, this is the song that actually has the lyric, Whole Lot of Love. You know, they copped it right from here and didn't credit the songwriter, which ultimately came back to bite them. So it was a case of another blues person getting his due.
Which is to say, Muddy Waters sued Led Zeppelin and got satisfaction?
To a certain degree, yeah. This actually was written by Willie Dixon, who wrote Hoochie Coochie Man as well, sort of became, you know, the Cyrano behind Muddy for a while, but he did get his due. I mean, his satisfaction, I think, yeah.
Outline some more of these threads that stretch from Muddy Waters and his music into the music of the rock and roll generation that followed him. Where can you see his stamp in the music of the great names that came after?
Well, he was really taken in by not only the Stones, but Eric Clapton, who was having big fame in the 70s with songs like I Shot the Sheriff. And on those big, big tours, he took Muddy's band as the opening act.
And what were they drawing from of Muddy's music and the musical tradition that he represents?
Well, I mean, I've, you know, read in interviews them say that, you know, they found a spiritual kinship with the blues, the sense of turmoil and angst, I think. Probably not the cotton picking specifically, but, you know, similar hard luck and hard work.
You write, Robert Gordon, that the blues is easy to turn into a cliche, a kind of neat stitch in the American quilt, the picturesque vision with all the right colors, Muddy's cabin down in the Delta. But you say it's wrong to see it as a, this kind of blues primitiveness or simplicity. That's a misinterpretation of the blues.
Oh, it's a, you know, the blues is a complex expression of feelings and how it's expressed. You know, I mean, there's a lot of bad blues out there, and that makes it evident how hard it is to do it right. And I think when it's done right, it takes us from our present state, transports us to a sense of relief and release. It embraces the paradoxes. You know, there's a lot of humor in the blues about the pain. Mm-hmm. So it's something that I think when Muddy was great, you could close your eyes and be taken back in time to another place. You know, it's great art.
You write that it's singing to relieve woefulness. It's feeling good about feeling bad, music born of pain but inspires pleasure, a vehicle that takes us from grief to relief. Was that explicit? Was it explicit in the juke joints in the Mississippi Delta when Muddy Waters was a young man? Was it explicit in the clubs in Chicago? Is that what people were looking for? Pick us up out of pain and take us somewhere that transmutes that into joy?
Absolutely, I think so. I think, you know, it began on Saturday nights in the clubs, in the juke joints, and then, you know, it went all the way on through until Sunday afternoon after church. You know, it was, again, two sides of the same coin, that wanting to know there's a salvation, that, you know, this can't be all there is, this life of labor and bad luck. And I think, you know, people invest themselves. That's why the blues continues to live and draw an audience. You know, it works as a universal.
What were Muddy Waters' final years like?
Oh, you know, he wore good suits. He moved to the suburbs, planted a garden. I loved when I went to see his house in the Chicago suburbs, it was right next to a train track. And I thought, oh, you know, he planted a big garden. So he had like little symbols of home right there for him.
Died in 1983. For a man who lived about a third of his life or more in the Delta, how did Mississippi stay with him, or did it? What was his attitude toward Mississippi and those roots?
Well, I think his great accomplishment was to give a voice to the dirt farmer, this society that had been neglected and ignored by the dominant white culture, became, through his life's work, the voice of America and of democracy in the latter half of the 20th century. You know, the blues and the rock that it spawned gave a voice to a disenfranchised people.
Did he ever want to go back to Mississippi?
He didn't long for it. He made a few returns there over his years. James Cotton told me they went to see his dad once, and he said there wasn't nothing to do but chop on a persimmon tree in the front yard. So I don't think there was a lot drawing him back.
That's slow. Robert Gordon, it's been great talking with you tonight. Thanks so much for joining us and giving us a tour of the life and music of Muddy Waters.
Well, Tom, thanks very much for having me on point, and let's do it again.
I'm sure we'll have a chance to. Robert Gordon is author of Can't Be Satisfied, The Life and Times of Muddy Waters. Let's go out with the 1970s version, the old Muddy Waters still playing strong, of Mannish Boy.
Second cousin, that's little John the Conqueror. All you little girls sitting out that line, I can make love to you, woman, in 5 minutes time. Ain't that a man? country band.
Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. Coming up, a look back at this week's news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. First, let's look back at the sounds of this past week.
I think it's a confirmation that they're trying to weaponize it. And even if they're not trying to weaponize it, they're certainly, by making a videotape, is preying on the psychology of fear, the very essence of terrorism. Al-Qaeda is also a very patient organization. They will strike where we least expect it.
The likelihood that Iraq is liquidated or killed Abu Nidal is very high. I would put it at 99%. Highly unlikely to commit suicide and you have multiple gunshots on Abu Nidal. So in a way, the Iraqis wanted to prove to the world that they got rid of a notorious terrorist.
The Iraqi opposition went into the offices of the Iraqi officials in Berlin, and several officials were threatened with weapons. And there has been a letter claiming responsibility, and the members of the Iraqi opposition stressed in this letter that their intentions are peaceful.
What I need to do is to continue to, as we call it, consult with people who share our interests to make the world a safer place, and I will do so. The American people know my position, and that is that regime change is in the interest of the world.
Nobody had expected a level of 9 meters. The place in front of the Semper Opera House is already touched by the floods, and the historic building, Semper Opera House, and also the building where the Old Masters Gallery is inside are touched by the water.
I think this will all be resolved in the very near future, and I will be exonerated.
Either she can comply with those subpoenas or face possibly being declared in contempt of Congress, which is a serious offense in itself. That could be a very serious blow for her company.
There are several aspects of Mr. Copper's plea that are helpful. With his cooperation, the knowledge of the company problems at Enron and the company misconduct will be more easy to establish.
In Yijiang, along the Dongting River, I just had a briefing with the vice mayor. So far, 1,000 people have been evacuated. Thanks to the reinforcement of the banks, it did prevent a catastrophe or a disaster to happen, even though presently the level of the waters continues to rise, and it still is very worrying for the population.
There's a week, CNN tapes of Al-Qaeda training exercises, Abu Nidal dead in Baghdad, the takeover of the Iraqi embassy in Berlin, President Bush saying he will consult allies on military action against Iraq, flooding in Dresden, Martha Stewart saying she'll cooperate with Congress, Enron executive Michael Copper entering a guilty plea, and a peasant army fighting a new flood, a flooding lake in central China. Jack Beatty, the Enron story got much stiffer this week. Suddenly there's a plea bargain and a lot of information starting to pour out, and a fairly relatively junior executives giving back or turning over $12 million of his own dollars.
Yes, and let's hope that's a precedent for more money and more executives. You know, just a couple of weeks ago, Senator Daschle and other Democrats were drawing invidious comparisons between how rapidly the Bush administration was moving against some of these companies and how slow against Enron. And the New York Times was pretty much saying, well, there's not much going on with Enron. Well, there apparently really was something going on. And this is serious. This young man, Michael Copper, arrogant, slavish to Fastow and corrupt, was apparently in cahoots with him, kicking back to him on the partnerships and engaging in other dubious propositions. He apparently was fond of wearing Prada clothing, and that led to someone at Enron saying, I wonder if Prada makes any striped suits.
He is facing potentially years in prison, even with the plea bargain, and big money that's been taken out of his bank accounts and turned over to the government. Do you think, Jack, that this is the kind of step that will send a resounding signal through corporate executive suites?
Well, yeah. I mean, we've had people on the program saying how hard it is to get this money, but the Justice Department doesn't seem to be, you know, in other words, if people fork it over, you know, they don't have to go through a legal proceeding. They say, you cooperate with us, give us the money, or you get a heavier penalty. That's a great way to get a lot of recovery going without having to go to court for it.
And you know how scary the prosecutors can be when they get you in the back room doing the plea bargain.
Yes, indeed. And there have been some reports that Fastow, who's the sort of the nexus of this, is himself talking about some kind of plea deal, which points the finger up to Jeffrey Skilling and to Mr. Lay. And we hear that Jeffrey Skilling is in despair, can't leave his house. He just doesn't understand it.
Could be a full house here, a big house.
Yes.
We hear President Bush backpedaling ever so slightly, saying he'll consult with allies before military action in Iraq, but saying the American people know where I stand on regime change. Is this backpedaling or buying time, buying calm?
Yeah, he may well be buying calm. Last week, as you know, there was just a flurry of criticism and doubt from people, nominally on his side, Republicans. Now he says he's consulting with allies, and recently we've had the British Foreign Secretary on our television saying that Britain really has no stomach for this. They favor inspections, and the British public, according to the New York Times, only 19% support British participation. That's going to be very tough for Tony Blair, 19% support to go ahead with helping the U.S.
And odd ripples around the Iraq front, maybe the fog of war moving in here with the debate over what happened to Abu Nidal, suicide or murder, the takeover of the Iraqi embassy in Berlin, maybe fog of war moving in.
Maybe moving in, and something's moving out. The Saudis have been withdrawing billions from U.S. banks, and oil prices are rising steadily.
Time, history, marches on, maybe boots as well. Jack, have a great weekend.
Okay, you too.
On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. And a special thanks and goodbye to intern extraordinaire Samantha Sodikson. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Have a great weekend.